Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. An unassuming granny who seemed to have her share of bad luck, a crippling prescription pill addiction, which she blamed for her bad decisions. Was she responsible for her heinous actions, or could it all be blamed on her addiction? You tell me. Okay, on to the show. Margie Velma Barfield was born on October 29, 1932, in Sampson County, South Carolina, to Murphy and Lily Bullard. Though born in South Carolina, the family eventually moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina. She would be the second out of nine children that the pair would have together. Murphy was a farmer by trade, mostly growing and harvesting tobacco and cotton. However, his farm did not bring in enough money for Murphy to support his family, so he took a job working in a local textile mill. The family was not well off, and Velma began to notice a difference between her and her classmates. She lived in a home, but had no running water, electricity, or even an outhouse. She literally had to go into the woods and take care of business. Velma was embarrassed by having to do this. She would take notice when beginning school that her classmates were better off than her. They had nicer clothes, more toys, and always a nickel more than she did. She started stealing from her father at age 7. She would sneak into her parents' room and take money from her father's pockets. She began showing off when she returned to school. Now she was able to afford the small luxuries like a candy or a soda pop after school. When she stole, it was for her own purpose. In order to satisfy her greed, Velma had to branch out in her theft. She began spending more and more time with an elderly neighbor. Her family was proud of the caring young lady she was becoming. Until one day, when the neighbor reported $80 missing from her pocketbook. In the 1940s, this was a considerable amount of money. When the neighbor confronted Velma's father and informed him of her theft, he beat her senseless. It would be the last time during her childhood that she would steal. Murphy did buy his daughter small luxuries here and there when he could, but his love came with a more sinister caveat. He began abusing Velma physically and sexually. Lily, ever the meek wife, stood by and allowed her husband to have his way with their daughter. Velma wrote in her memoir, titled Woman on Death Row, "I seem to accept Daddy's high-tempered ways because I thought that's the way men are. Mama should love their children and stand up for them, and Mama never stood up for me, or any of us." In 1945, at the age of 13, Velma was raped by her father for the very first time. This type of abuse changed Velma. She began to resent her mother for standing by and allowing her to be abused, and she resented any man that reminded her of her father. That's why just 4 years later, she met and married her high school sweetheart, Thomas Burke. She was 17 and had finally found a way out of her dysfunctional home life. Thomas and Velma dropped out of high school and decided to start working and build a family. She was safe with Thomas. He was kind and caring to her, the complete opposite of her father. She knew that her life wasn't going to be marvelous with Thomas. While his personality didn't match her father's, his work did. Both Thomas and Murphy worked in the textile plant. Despite the guarantee of a very humble life, Velma was happy to be away from her father's grip and lust. 2 years into their marriage, on December 15th, 1951, she gave birth to her son, Ronnie. He was a joy to Velma. She never felt love like that before and doted on him endlessly. Thomas and Velma welcomed daughter Kim on September 3rd, 1953. One could say that this was Velma's happiest time. She had a loving husband and two beautiful children. It couldn't get any better than this. Unfortunately for Velma, she would only have 10 years of bliss. In 1964, health complications forced Velma to undergo a hysterectomy. Instead of relieving the pain she was in, Velma claimed that having the hysterectomy only made it worse. She was prescribed the highly addictive benzodiazepine called Librium to reduce her pain. She grew dependent on the pills, needing them daily for her pain that possibly didn't really exist. Her growing addiction to the pills and the death of Thomas's father in 1966 turned Velma's life upside down. Thomas, the once lively and loving husband, grieved the loss of his father. He turned to alcohol and drank every night. He became loud and abusive. Velma began to feel pure hatred for him. She was reminded of her father anytime Thomas got drunk. Velma's emotional strength was worn down by her drug use, and she just couldn't handle the constant fighting with Thomas. She had a breakdown in late 1966 that led to a stay in a hospital. A doctor prescribed her another benzodiazepine, Valium. This would prove to be a fatal mistake. Her addiction to the drugs intensified after she was prescribed the Valium. Even Velma would attribute this to her future acts of cruelty. She and Thomas lived this cycle of violence for 3 additional years. She finally had enough. She wasn't going to be weak like her mother and just stand by while Thomas spiraled out of control. She was going to take matters into her own hands and stand up for herself and her children. On April 21st, 1969, Velma walked into the bedroom she shared with her husband and looked around. She knew Thomas was sleeping off the alcohol and decided to let him rest. Only, her intention was for the rest to be eternal. She lit a cigarette and left it on the bed and exited the home. She returned a few hours later to the flames that once engulfed her home, just smoldering. She fiend terror and inquired about her husband. She was told by the firemen on the scene that Thomas perished in the fire. Velma collapsed in hysterics and put on the show of her life. At the time, they ruled his death an accident. Thomas was dead, and now she could move on. However, it wasn't that easy. Her psyche just wouldn't let her. She suffered another nervous breakdown and was hospitalized after his death. After she was released, she took her children and went to live with her mother and father. Her father was battling lung cancer. In November of 1969, she began dating Jennings Barfield, who suffered from a myriad of illnesses and diseases such as diabetes, emphysema, and heart disease. Velma enjoyed taking care of him, and eventually they married in 1970. She was again happy to be out of her parents' home. But the marriage would prove to be tumultuous until its end. Jennings found out about Velma's drug use only after they married, and was known to vocalize his regrets. In 1971, tragedy would strike yet another one of Velma's husbands. Jennings and Velma were eating breakfast one day when he took a sip of his coffee and died. Velma didn't know what to do. She was in a state of shock. She was just speaking to him. She called for an ambulance and Jennings was taken from the home. Doctors would say that his heart just gave out. Velma was devastated by the loss of her husband. She was happy with him and she couldn't come to grips with his death. She suffered yet another breakdown and was admitted into the hospital. It was Jennings' death that led her family to believe Velma was cursed. She was in the hospital when she heard that her father had passed. It seemed as if she couldn't catch a break from tragedy. She would ingest one too many pills in 1972 and was treated for an overdose. Her family rallied for her to pull through and didn't blame or fault her for trying to end her life. While she did have beautiful children, she did lose 2 husbands and a father back to back. Her family rationalized her behavior by telling themselves that anyone would have a breakdown after so much tragedy. But all they were failing to do was recognize just how tightly Velma was in the grasp of her addiction. She used the sympathy to hide her tracks as she began stealing from her mother to pay for her drugs. She would forge checks and take out loans under her mother's name. She did this for over 1.5 years until her mother finally caught wind of what she was doing. Forensic psychologist Paula Orange, who spoke with author Georgia Johnson, had this to say about this time period in Velma's life. Velma needed psychiatric help, so she began medicating herself with disastrous results. She would doctor shop for different physicians who would be manipulated into giving her the drugs she wanted. Her addiction eventually grows until she becomes so desperate for money in order to fuel the drug habit. In December of 1972, Lily received a letter in the mail from the bank letting her know that her loan payment was overdue. She was confused as she had never taken a loan out. Velma tried to quell her mother's concern over the loan, but their relationship was strained and Lily could not be reasoned with. A few days later, Lily was rushed to the hospital, doubled over with pain so great that she could hardly tell doctors what hurt. Doctors couldn't pinpoint what exactly was causing the illness and tried to help her. Velma visited her mother in the hospital and brought her some homemade soup. She wanted to save her mother, but it was too late. Lily's condition eventually worsened, and she passed away from the illness on December 30th, 1974. Her death was cited as natural causes. However, there was one person who knew exactly what was wrong with Lily. Velma. Velma had poisoned her mother with arsenic before an investigation into the fraudulent loan could begin. She had no other choice. Getting caught meant that the drugs would stop, and she needed them too badly to let anyone get in the way. She was now stuck. She had no extra income to support her drug habit. She began writing hot checks, which eventually led to her arrest. She was sentenced to 3 months in jail. You would think that this would be Velma's rock bottom, but it wasn't. Upon her release, she took up caring for the elderly. This gave her access to some of the most vulnerable people. In 1976, her first ward was 94-year-old Montgomery Edwards. She would steal checks, cash, and prescription drugs from Montgomery and his wife, 86-year-old Dolly. Montgomery, though up in age, began to notice checks missing from his checkbook. He brought this up in passing to Velma, and she knew what she had to do. She slowly began poisoning him with arsenic. What is strange is that Velma seemed to develop a sort of Munchausen by proxy syndrome. She was enjoying the attention and admiration she received for nursing Montgomery back to health. His body just couldn't handle the poison, and he eventually passed away in January of 1977. She consoled Dolly over the loss of her husband. Family members thanked Velma for her kindness and for looking after Dolly. They were relieved to have her by Dolly's side just a few months later. She seemed to have contracted the same illness as her late husband. She had fever, chills, and violent vomiting, but she would pass in February of that same year. When her services ended for the Edwards family, they bestowed gifts to her in gratitude for the care she took of Montgomery. She moved on to Lumberton, North Carolina to care for another elderly couple, John Henry Lee, age 80, and Record Lee, age 76. Again, family members were pleased with the amount of care Velma was showing the aging couple. They were thankful for the care Velma showed John Henry when he became violently ill. She would nurse him slowly back to health, and the family would sing her praises. Once she got her fill, she poisoned him again. What prompted this? Velma believed that John Henry had discovered she was stealing from them. She was not going to risk getting caught or going back to jail, so she just did what she had to do. John Henry perished in June of 1977. Record was also a target of Velma's, but her life was ultimately spared because Velma met a man named Stuart Taylor. She was quickly smitten with him and left the employ of Record to live with him. Stuart was a 56-year-old widowed tobacco farmer. In just a few short months, Velma moved into his home. Although Velma was deeply religious, she did not have a problem living with a man out of wedlock. Velma was 46 and attractive. Stuart was happy and proud to have her on his arm. Although he wasn't as religious as Velma, he tried to engage in her interests. He would go to church with her, but it seemed he did so more so to show off Velma than to listen to the word of the Lord. Regardless, it made Velma happy to have a man who would attend her beloved church with her. One day, Stuart came across a letter addressed to Velma. He wasn't the type to go through someone's mail, but this letter was different. It came from a woman's prison. Curious, Stuart opened the letter. Looking back, this would be a mistake that cost him his life. He was shocked to learn that the inmate writing Velma was once a cellmate of hers. Stuart became furious. If she didn't tell him about her time in prison, what else was she hiding? He aimed to confront her. She arrived home and found the letter opened. Angry, she asked why he opened it. He retorted that she was a liar and he was going to expose her. She wasn't as godly as she made herself to seem. Besides opening the letter, Stuart's other fatal mistake was to threaten Velma. Velma didn't take well to threats. They argued and argued until they came to an impasse. The tension was strong in the home for the next few days. Stuart must have thought that Velma turned over a new leaf when she invited him to church one January afternoon. After the invitation, she handed him a beer and kissed his cheek. He at some point noticed checks were missing from his checkbook. He tried to account for the absent checks, but when he couldn't, he questioned Velma. She, of course, denied it. He was on to her. Her prison stint meant that she was a thief. Stealing checks was right up her alley. Despite his suspicions, he agreed to accompany Velma to church, but he felt something was off the entire car ride home. He was able to get through the service without vomiting everywhere, but once he got into the car, he couldn't keep his composure and was rushed to the hospital. She would nurse him back to health, and for a time, he would feel better. Doctors believe that he had gastritis, which is an inflammation, irritation, or erosion of the lining of the stomach. It's usually not fatal. He was sent home with some medication. Velma would use this illness to her benefit. She would take Stuart's checkbook and write checks out to herself. She figured it was payment for nursing him back to health. He would want her to have it. Stuart's illness intensified on February 3, 1978. Velma offered him herbal tea to settle his stomach, but his symptoms seemed to worsen after each sip. He was rushed to the hospital, where he later passed away. The cause of death was unknown, but at the request of his children, an autopsy was performed. Stuart's children had suspicions about his death. Their father was a strong man who never had been sick a day in his life. Someone, presumably Velma, had to be responsible for his illness and ultimate death. Stuart's children told Velma that an autopsy was ordered, possibly to gauge her reaction. She showed no concern. And why would she? Lily had an autopsy after her death, and still, no one found out her secret. Despite knowing that all eyes were on her, Velma played the part of the grieving girlfriend. She attended the funeral along with her son Ronnie, and wept. People were touched by her display of emotion. Ronnie felt sorry for his mother. He had been a witness to the tragedy that was her life, ever since his father died. He recalls telling one funeral attendee,
"You know, it's the saddest thing, but it seems like everybody my mother ever gets close to dies. How could the good Lord allow this to happen to a good, faithful Christian like Velma Barfield?"
He would later be haunted by those words. Velma completely relished in the attention. Did the pills block her emotion, or was she just a cold-blooded killer who got a thrill out of all this? There was someone else, someone much closer to her, who became suspicious of Velma's activities. And the death of Stuart forced her to bring her suspicions to light. The same day of Stuart's funeral, Velma's sister, who remained anonymous, phoned Benson Phillips, a Lumberton police detective. She was inconsolable and only uttered, "Murder. I know who did it. You've got to stop her. You've got to stop her." Phillips thought he was on the other end of a crank call and disconnected. He hadn't heard of any murders in the town as of today. His phone rang yet again, and this time, the caller was more composed. She said she didn't want to give her personal information, but she would share details of what she did know. She said she was currently living in South Carolina and knew that a man named Stuart Taylor had been murdered by his girlfriend, Velma Barfield. Velma, the caller said, was also responsible for murdering her own mother, Lily Bullard. The puzzled detective continued to listen to this woman's claims and was intrigued by what she was saying. He was surprised that she could offer no proof of her claims. Benson asked how she was confident that Velma was the killer. The caller responded with, "I'm her sister." The call ended, and Benson was just as confused about the second call he received from the distraught caller. He knew that no murders had recently occurred, so he called over to Lumberton Hospital and asked if anyone had recently passed. He knew it was a silly question to ask a hospital of all places, but he was shocked to hear the name Stuart Taylor. He inquired if there was an autopsy being performed. Perplexed, the staff answered yes, but that the results were pending. He hung up the phone and called Wilbur Lovett, who worked in the sheriff's office. If Stuart was murdered, it was out of Benson's jurisdiction, so he called his friend Wilbur to share what he knew. Dr. Bob Andrews was completely unaware of any investigation. He finally received the autopsy results and was truly baffled. How could a generally healthy man pass away from an easily treatable illness? He decided to send some tissue out for testing. In the meantime, Dr. Andrews called over to North Carolina's chief medical examiner, Paige Hudson. Hudson asked Andrews for details about the death. Andrews told him about the girlfriend, Velma Barfield, who had brought Stuart Taylor to the hospital and described Taylor's symptoms. Hudson instantly grasped the situation. "Where'd she get the arsenic, Bob?" Hudson's assumption proved correct when Dr. Andrews got the results of the tissue samples. Stuart had high levels of arsenic in his system. His death was ruled a homicide. Attention quickly focused on Velma, and she was surprised to find detectives knocking on her door. She was relieved to know that they only wanted to inquire about the numerous bad checks she had written. She could deal with that. She was interrogated by Benson because the checks were written and cashed in Lumberton. The sheriff's office was on hand to witness the interrogation. Benson brought up Stuart's recent passing. Velma stated it was tragic. Then Benson asked, "Do you know he was killed by arsenic?" Velma sat straight up and seemed surprised by this question. He continued to question her about their relationship and if they had recently fought. Velma retorted in rage, "Y'all think I poisoned Stuart, don't you?" She thought this was such an absurd assumption. After all, she was the one who had nursed the poor man through his illness. She was the one who had rushed him to the hospital. And now, they were trying to throw dirt on all her good work. It was absurd. The detectives left, and Velma immediately reached out to her son, Ronnie. Ronnie, like the rest of Velma's family, was aware of her addiction, but he was always the one she would turn to when she was in the most trouble. When she called him distraught, he knew it must have been because she had run out of money. He was shocked to hear that she had just been questioned about Stuart's death and that they seemed to think he was poisoned by her. Ronnie was certain that police had the wrong person. Days later, he received a call from a friend of Velma's who said she would be arrested for the murder of Stuart's death. The friend worked for the sheriff's department and just wanted him to be aware. Concerned and enraged, he went to the sheriff's office to speak with Wilbur Lovett. Lovett said he was not planning on arresting his mother that day, but that she was considered a suspect. Abruptly, Ronnie left and went to the house where his mother was staying. It belonged to Mamie Warwick, a senior citizen who allowed Velma to live rent-free in exchange for her doing some household chores. He found his mother napping and woke her to tell him what he learned. She sobbed and said she didn't do it intentionally, that it was all an accident. Ronnie wasn't sure if he had heard his mother right. An accident? He told his mother that while it might have been an accident, she caused it. She had to speak to the police. He drove her to the sheriff's office where she told her story. She only wanted to make Stuart sick and nurse him back to health. She might have given him too much and it took his life, and for that, she was sorry. It didn't take much for Velma to ultimately reveal the tangled web of lies and murder she had weaved for over 9 years. Ronnie phoned his sister Kim and told her what was going on. She was distraught by the news, but it was only the beginning. Ronnie spoke to investigator Al Parnell. Parnell told Ronnie, "There are other people she's killed. She has confessed to killing 2 people to whom she had been a paid live-in caregiver, and her own mother." Ronnie was shocked. He shared with his sister what he had just learned. They lost it. Velma was booked on first-degree murder for the death of Stuart Taylor. Her trial began on November 27, 1978. Her defense strategy remained the same as her initial confession. She made Stuart ill, so she had time to cover up her theft and eventually return the money she had stolen. His death was accidental. She loved him and wanted to be his wife. She would have never intentionally hurt the man she loved. Prosecutor Joe Freeman Britt was nicknamed the world's deadliest prosecutor for his arduous support of the death penalty and for winning 13 death penalty cases in just 17 months. Unlike Prosecutor Britt, Velma's defense attorney Bob Jacobson was more inexperienced. Velma would be his first death penalty case. Britt's main goal was to prove that Velma intentionally meant to bring about Stuart's death. He asked the judge to allow for the submission of other deaths Velma was connected to: John Henry Lee, Montgomery and Dottie Edwards, and her own mother, Lily Bullard. Velma's attorney argued that submitting the evidence of their deaths would be prejudicial and compromise Velma's ability to get a fair trial. Considering the arguments, the judge allowed the evidence to be submitted. A myriad of witnesses would take the stand to testify on Stuart's cause of death, his overall health, his relationship with Velma, and Velma's relationship with drugs. None of the medical professionals who were called to testify on behalf of the defense could say that Velma was in a state of lunacy because of the drugs. She did exhibit signs of being bipolar, and perhaps a combination of medications had to do with her behavior, but it was not the behavior of an insane person. Jacobson knew he was taking a risk by allowing his client to testify on her behalf, but he had to take that gamble. He felt that she would be the best person to explain her confused state of mind. He was wrong. She was cordial and pleasant when speaking to her own attorney, but when Prosecutor Britt got up to begin his questioning, a clear change washed over Velma. He addressed her in a hostile tone, and Velma, not realizing the trap he was setting, responded the same. She made outlandish statements and insinuated that she had not killed her victims. Rather, they just coincidentally happened to die after she poisoned them. In part, she said, "What I would like your honor to say to the jury and all, these autopsies, let me say first of all, when a person dies and they ask for an autopsy to be performed, is it not true that we have an autopsy performed to find out the reason of the death? So I don't believe it killed them really. The first autopsy said it was natural causes, not poisoning. That is exactly the way I feel about it." Closing statements were made, and when Prosecutor Britt finished his, Velma mockingly clapped. Britt had exactly what he needed, and he knew her fate was sealed at this point. The jury saw Velma for who she really was, a remorseless killer. It should be no surprise that she was found guilty of murder, and given Prosecutor Britt's experience with winning death penalty cases, it should be no surprise that she was sentenced to death. At the time of her sentencing, she was the only woman sentenced to death in North Carolina. There was not a death row for her to go to. Instead, she was sent to the Central Prison Section for mental cases. During her time in prison, Velma did what she could to stay comfortable. She had to be weaned off the drugs, which was difficult. She said she was born again and rediscovered her love of God while in prison. Her time would go by and she would turn into a model prisoner. If you recall the case of Carla Faye Tucker, Velma had much of the same characteristics she had in prison. Velma was well liked among the staff and other inmates. She even had more troubled women placed in the cell next to hers, so she could counsel them, often with success. There were many people who Velma met during her time in prison that would come to her aid during her appeals, claiming she was a changed woman. Of course, this turn to the holy created skeptics. Was this a ploy to avoid the death penalty? Was she really sincere? Some believe she was. Famous evangelist Billy Graham and his wife Ruth would call Velma their sister in Christ. She was confronted by her son and daughter over the death of their father. Velma confided that her memory was hazy, but that she was likely responsible for his death and for the death of Jennings Barfield. Velma reached out to the family of the people she killed. All of her requests for forgiveness went unanswered. Having exhausted all of her appeals, Velma had one final attempt for clemency. She hoped to find it in North Carolina's governor, James Hunt. He refused her request because of the way her victims were tortured. Although he was running for a U.S. Senate seat, Hunt said that politics had nothing to do with his decision. Here's what Velma had to say about her impending execution.
I'm sorry for the hurt that I've caused so many people. Today, if it were possible, I wish that I could take every bit of hurt on myself.
On November 2nd, 1984, Velma prepared herself for a final time. She took a final communion, dressed herself in cotton pajamas and a robe. Outside the prison were crowds of people cheering for Velma's death. They even started a chant, "Kill the bitch." Velma entered the execution chamber and recited her final words. "I want to say that I am sorry for all the hurt that I have caused. I know that everybody has gone through a lot of pain, all the families connected, and I'm sorry. I want to thank everybody who has been supporting me all these 6 years. I want to thank my family for standing with me through all this, and my attorneys, and all the support to me, everybody, the people with the prison department. I appreciate everything, their kindness, and everything that they have shown me during these 6 years." At 2:15 a.m., she was pronounced dead by lethal injection, an ironic end for prisoner Velma Barfield. As I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or a general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. I would like to welcome the newest club members. Our most recent Patreon supporters are Benjamin S., Sam S., The Curiosity Kills Podcast, so Haley and Lindsay, Gemma, Holly M., Stephanie E., Christy T., and Megan M. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams. Did you hear our new tagline? That means we had a winner. But our contest winner has decided to remain anonymous and not accept any of the prizes. That means you have an opportunity to win one of the several prizes available. You will have until June 4th to submit your name for a chance to win. Head over to the website for info on how to enter. Research assistance and content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. I recently started a Facebook discussion group where we can discuss the cases more in depth. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group and one of our lovely mods will add you. We are planning on starting a book club in the discussion group, so be sure to join in. Brittany's going to be leading the pack with the first book. I can't wait to see what she picks. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
After learning about some of history's most evil deeds on the True Crime Fan Club podcast, come discover history's naughtiest secrets on our new show, The Dirty Bits Podcast, available on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, Facebook, and tawnyvoice.com/The Dirty Bits Podcast. A podcast devoted to the dirty bits of history your teacher probably left out.
Hey everybody, this is Steven.
And this is Chris.
And we're the hosts of the brand new podcast, Is This Adulting?
Every week, we're going to sit down to have a discussion about life, culture, our own mental health struggles, and just about anything you can think of.
Have you ever wondered which breakfast cereal's the best?
Or how to help your friends who are dealing with mental illness?
Or why waterbeds were a thing?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then have we got a show for you.
And remember, kids, be happy, stay healthy, and go hug someone.
Because you never know, they might just be starting a podcast.
As well as seeing the mysterious figure at the foot of her bed, my auntie also tells me that on a different occasion, again sleeping in the room, she was woken during the night with the sensation that once again something was in the room. But instead of seeing an unexplained figure, she began to feel something pulling at the bedsheets before being ripped away from her and thrown to the floor. There was no one else in the room with her, but she was more than aware that she was being made to feel very unwelcome.
Hello. I hope, like myself, you've enjoyed the true crime stories. But if, like me, you are a fan of ghost stories and spooky experiences, then please take a listen to the Noisy Spirit podcast show. The show includes true listener ghost stories, the occasional fictional tale, and a classic UK ghost story. All narrated by myself, Noisy Spirit, Dave. The ghost stories include real experiences of shadow people, ghost children, dark entities, poltergeist hauntings, and more. You get the idea. So if you're a fan of everything spooky and supernatural, then please take a listen and subscribe to the Noisy Spirit podcast show on iTunes. You can also listen and download the show on the website, noisyspirit.com. There, you can also contact me and submit your ghost story or spooky experience for the show.
Well, we just have to record like a quick, like 30-second commercial or something to get people to listen to the show.
But you want us to do like freestyle?
I mean, we do the whole show basically freestyle anyway. We might as well.
You make a fair point.
So, like, if you want, if you like aliens or like base paint.
Yeah, but if we script something, it'll at least sound like we're not retarded.
But we are kind of. And also, it's our warm personalities coming through the promotion.
Wait. So we scripted this show to this blur where it's not scripted about how we script this blur? Okay, got it. Yeah, that's what we're doing right now. Go.
Weird Shit Podcast. You should listen to it.
Hey guys, this is Arielle, host of Murder Under the Midnight Sun, an Alaskan true crime podcast. I've lived in Alaska now for over 30 years and have been a true crime junkie for almost as long and decided to combine those two things into a podcast. I'll be covering a wide variety of crimes from all across the state, everything from mass murders to serial killers to missing persons cases and beyond. So if you want to hear some compelling true crime stories that have never been covered by any other podcast, or hear about some horrible serial killers whose names you've never heard, go ahead and give me a listen. You can find me on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow me on Twitter at MurderTheSun. Thanks.
Hey, podcast fans. I'm Rachel, the host of We're All Mad Here, a new podcast about the history of mental health. We're covering everything from creepy asylums and their notable residents to questionable cures and their consequences. Join us for our first episode on June 20th. You can find us online at allmadpod.com and be ready for an adventure, because the history of mental health is insane.